This is The Takeaway for Friday, July 7th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. The G20 summit got off to a turbulent start in Hamburg, Germany, as protesters clashed with police on Thursday evening. The summit kicks off today and brings together leaders from the world's largest economies. President Trump enters the talks with America's traditional allies on edge. Areas like climate change, immigration policy, trade, and security have all put the president at odds with European leaders. Some of those leaders, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel, have signaled that American leadership on those issues is no longer reliable. Now, meetings are meetings, and they do have a way of blending together, but one stands out from the sidelines here: President Trump's meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. It comes at a time back home when numerous investigations are digging into how Russia worked to tip the 2016 election in Trump's favor, and also at a time when Russia and other countries are maneuvering to fill what they perceive as a power vacuum. To consider what's at stake with Russia and other economic leaders, we turn now to Nicholas Vozdev. He's professor of national security studies at the U.S. Naval War College, and he says that even before this G20 summit began, leaders in China and Germany were already signaling that the U.S. was becoming isolated.
It's very clear that after Xi Jinping made an unexpected and unneeded stop in Moscow to visit with Vladimir Putin, whom he was going to see at the G20 anyway, for him to then go on and to have dinner with Angela Merkel, and for Xi Jinping and Angela Merkel, in essence, after that dinner, to give the impression that they are the two, if we can use this term, grown-ups in the room, that they are the two principal actors around which the global agenda will revolve, that's a real slap in the face to the president, because it suggests that for the first time since the G20 has begun to meet, the American president is no longer automatically setting the agenda, not necessarily the one who will be sitting in the chairman's seat when the leaders of the most critical countries in the world are discussing the issues of the day.
What's the primary basis of that? Is it climate change and the Paris Accords, or is it something more?
It's a mix of things. Climate change certainly has been the wedge issue that the Chinese and the Germans have found common cause on. But I think it's also a sense that there is a global order that has benefited most of the states of the G20, that they are not sure that Donald Trump is committed to the continuation of that global order, or at least is seeking to revise it or revise the American role in it, what the Americans are expected to pay for and to contribute to. And this is a way of suggesting that perhaps, as the title of that famous book from the last decade suggested, we might begin to move into a post-American world, a post-American global order.
President Trump meets with Vladimir Putin today, just after his meetings in Poland before coming to Germany, and he made these statements concerning Russian meddling in the American elections in 2016. Listen.
I said it very simply. I think it could very well have been Russia, but I think it could well have been other countries, and I won't be specific, but I think a lot of people interfere. I think it's been happening for a long time. It's been happening for many, many years.
Nicholas Vozdev, this continued equivocation from the president on the issue of Russia meddling in the American election, not to mention European elections, after the assessment from the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, and the intelligence community that it was Russia. How important is this with Vladimir Putin on the scene?
I think what he is attempting to do is not wanting to box the Russians in. There's been a lot of pressure on President Trump to bring up this issue with the Russians, to really read the Riot Act to the Russians. And the Russians have signaled all along that if that's what a U.S. president wants to spend his time and agenda points in a meeting on, then they don't need to discuss things like North Korea or Syria or any of the other issues that are on the table. So I think what we've seen the president doing is wanting to preserve some freedom of maneuver, which increasingly is being restricted as Congress is moving ahead with tightening the sanctions on Russia. I think the president is faced with the reality that his maneuvering room and his ability to try to craft a deal with the Russians is diminishing by day. And the Russians, I think, are also now beginning to realize that.
I mean, you're describing a dynamic where in a realpolitik world, the president may not want to bring up Russian meddling because he doesn't want to box the Russians in. They won't want to talk to him about other things. But then the converse is true as well. An American president who is boxed in himself can't push back against foreign meddling in an American election for fear that he won't be able to maneuver with an adversary.
That's a problem. That's the dilemma that he is beginning to deal with now, and that his national security team is also very concerned about. That is the president in these statements undermining the ability of the United States to be able to call out such behavior and, if necessary, to sanction it so as to prevent a repeat of it happening, whether it's our congressional elections in 2018, whether it's another set of the German elections forthcoming in Europe later this year, and other areas. So I think it really speaks to that dilemma that he faces, and that I think that his national security team is attempting to balance for him.
You have been watching the China-Russia relationship very closely for signs of strategy when it comes to the United States. What have you been seeing there?
Both the Russians and the Chinese are not happy with things that the Trump administration has been doing, whether it's on Syria, Ukraine, Korea, the maritime zones. And the meeting that was held in Moscow between the Russian and the Chinese presidents was a clear signal that they feel that they have options by working with each other, that the United States is not the only game in town, and that if the United States continues to press, that Russia and China can find ways to work together to strengthen their position and to raise costs for the United States. So that is something that I think American strategists have to look at, because for the last 40 years, American geopolitics has always been guided by the aphorism that you always want Moscow and Beijing to prize their relationship with Washington more than their relationship with each other. And if Russia and China do continue to move closer together, it does change the balance of power in the Eurasian space. And this is where you're going back to the original question about the Chinese and the Germans, is that if the Chinese and the Russians are moving closer together, the United States does need to shore up its allies and alliances in both Europe and in the Far East in order to do that. But if you're alienating both your allies and you are creating conditions for potential adversaries to move closer together, the end result is a United States that'll find itself isolated on every front.
Nicholas Vostev, thank you.
Thank you.
Nicholas Vostev is professor of national security studies at the U.S. Naval War College. A year ago today, four police officers and a transit cop were shot and killed in Dallas. The shooting came following a prayer rally and a night of otherwise peaceful protests in response to the death of two African-American men by police in Louisiana and Minnesota earlier that week. The tragedy in Dallas raised the specter of targeted killings of police officers after episodes of police violence against civilians were increasingly caught on tape. David Brown was the chief of the Dallas police on that night those five officers were killed. After the shooting, he talked about the attacker.
The suspect said he was upset about Black Lives Matter. He said he was upset about the recent police shootings. The suspect said he was upset at white people. The suspect stated he wanted to kill white people, especially white officers.
David Brown led the Dallas Police Department from 2010 to 2016. He's now retired and has a new memoir out. It's titled Call to Rise, A Life in Faithful Service to the Community That Made Me. David Brown spoke to me about police transparency, how tragedy in his own life changed his views of policing, and that night on July 7th that delivered the worst news of his professional career.
If you recall, over the July 4th weekend last year, there was the Alton Sterling shooting and the Philando Castile shooting. And this had reached a boiling point between community and police relationships, so that we were all concerned, all the major cities especially, were all concerned about the protests potentially getting violent, or, you know, there'd be property damage, or people just be so frustrated with what they were seeing in other parts of the country as it relates to police-involved shootings, that it would spill over into other cities that did not experience those types of conflicts with their communities. So we had worked really hard with the protest leadership, and we knew the game plan. We knew what they were planning to do. There was no plans at all in any of the discussions we had in weeks leading up to July 7th of any type of disruption.
You went home that night thinking the protests were pretty much wrapping up. You took off your belt, went home to relax, and then your phone rang. What happened?
Yes. What happened is that the protesters had a scheduled speech, and that ended, and the crowd began to leave. And as they dispersed, I told my second-in-command, hey, just let me know when the last protester leaves. Unbeknownst to me, they spontaneously began to march, and I get a first phone call. The second-in-command, David Pugh, called me out of breath, saying we had an officer down who was what we call low sick, which is grave, and that there was an active shooter and multiple shots fired. And I immediately threw my gun belt back on and headed toward our command center.
Is this your worst nightmare as a chief?
Yes.
Not only one officer down, but multiple?
Yes, because I had been at that point at least, I had been the longest serving chief since the 1940s here in Dallas. And I had not lost an officer in the line of duty. And that was something, as far as a legacy as a police chief, you just you pray for. And this news that night, and then it was like subsequently there was another officer's down, a fourth officer's down. And so we were, you know, just kind of in shock.
And you talk about the chaos of that night trying to respond to the sniper ultimately that was in a parking garage downtown as the nation watched on live news of this awful situation unfolding. Five officers killed, as we mentioned, and many days later, you spoke at the memorial service for those five fallen cops in front of President Obama and Michelle Obama, in front of President Bush and Laura Bush, and you said in your book that your private grief, not your decades of public service as chief, had best prepared you for that moment. Explain.
I had lost my police partner from the police academy, Walter Williams, 5 years into my career, wanted to quit. Then I lost my brother, a younger brother, to a drug dealer killing him. He was addicted to crack cocaine, my younger brother. And then I lost my mentally ill adult son, undiagnosed bipolar. He had a violent episode and killed two people and had to be killed by officers to prevent him from doing more harm. And so I had more than my fair share of personal grief and had to get through that and still be police chief. Through it all, that day on July 7th, the preparation was I knew exactly what to say to grieving families. I knew how they were feeling because I felt it in every way you can possibly grieve. My instincts kicked in a personal and professional way that it really did best prepare me to handle that situation.
Brown lost his police partner early in his career. Then his brother died in a drug-related killing. In 2010, Brown's son DJ was killed by police himself. DJ had adult-onset bipolar disorder, and he was killed after a violent episode where DJ shot and killed one civilian and a local police officer. That tragedy brought new intensity to the need for mental health treatment to David Brown, who says police should not be the first line of response in dealing with individuals with mental illness.
I'm not sure that our society should expect police officers to be able to resolve this. This is about policies and funding, choices we make as public officials in the way we legislate. And maybe a mental health professional or access to mental health professionals much more than we have and mental health facility capacity is more of a solution, which it costs dollars and it takes a commitment. But I just don't know that handcuffs are the handgun is going to be the solution, because at the end of the day, that's what cops have as a tool. We can talk to people ad nauseum, but at the end of the day, the behavior kind of dictates how the officer is going to react. Someone, you know, acting violently, it springs into action our tactics so that we can stay alive and so we can protect other people.
I want to also talk about the police that you led, the department that you led, and the debate that the country's having about policing now. You talk about 60 officers that you fired for misconduct from the Dallas Police Department during your tenure over the years. And it made me want to ask you about rules for disciplining cops, both within departments, but really in the courtrooms. The nation is watching as police officers either go on trial, but much more frequently get off or are exonerated after a shooting that to most layperson seems egregious. The case of Philando Castile is a prime example. Police claim in court, as you know, that in that moment they have fear for their life that can legally at least justify a shooting. Do these rules need to be changed that an officer can just claim fear for their life and basically no jury will convict them or no grand jury will indict them?
I think it's worth spending some time here before a yes or no answer on this issue. People want to give cops the benefit of the doubt. They do. And the reason why they want to give them the benefit of the doubt is because they risk their lives every day to protect us. And because they want to give them the benefit of the doubt, and the standard for convicting someone is beyond a reasonable doubt, therein lies your conflict. Even with egregious facts, jurors, you know, they take great consternation with convicting a cop who may have answered hundreds of thousands of calls the right way, and this one, he didn't or she didn't. And it's wrong. The tactics were wrong. Maybe even the motivations were wrong. But those juries are conflicted in convicting them. And I think that's the context of what happens as these cases go through the criminal justice system, is that people are torn and they conflate the cops they know with these cops on trial and say, let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's give them, and then you can never get a reason beyond a reasonable doubt standard conviction in these juries. And I'm not so sure that we should throw out our system of justice to get a conviction for that. I think it's downstream where we make the most significant change. And what I mean by that, I think it's at the local level where we screen, hire, and change the standards of how we can get people out that are not suited for the job, because there's a percentage that's just not suited to be a cop. We need to change all the processes in place that create barriers to get those people out of the profession.
You know, you're a cop, you were the boss, you're also a black man in America, and you say that diversity hiring in police departments for diversity's sake solves nothing, but that you do see it as a tool for effective policing. Do you see hiring of more minorities, more African Americans or other minorities connected to the problem of police-involved shooting?
Yes, and we got to be a little bit more strategic than we've been. I think hiring more people of color from urban centers to police urban centers, there's a unique issue in our urban centers here, in our inner cities. I grew up an inner city kid. It's a different conversation, different culture, different type of interactions. There's really entrenched poverty, generational poverty. And there's so many things that an officer can do and say to escalate things to violence, or so many things they can do and say to de-escalate things in these environments, that we need to be strategic in how we hire. And that may not always relate back to color. There's a lot of white cops that do a better job in the black community than some black cops do.
How much do we really know about where the problem is with police and minorities, police and African Americans, and whether African Americans are more likely to face the bad end of a police weapon when they have an interaction with a cop?
Well, I will point you toward Dallas's release when I was chief a couple of years ago of 12 years of police-involved shooting and excessive force data. And then there's been studies from Dallas's data that shows that race has not been something that has been intricate in deciding the outcome. But I will say perceptions mean everything in this particular case, especially when you see it on video. At the same time, you know, many of these incidents are caught on video and still not yielding the right outcomes. If you don't have the video, you have one person's word against another person's word. And what people in the community are saying, particularly in the communities of color, is the video just revealing what we've been saying for decades. So I'm 100% for body cams and more video, cell phones, whether it's person on the side of the road shooting a video. Transparency is always the better way.
The book is Called to Rise by former Dallas Police Chief David O. Brown. Chief, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Only a short time ago, Amelia Earhart checked over every detail of her $80,000 flying laboratory in preparation for her round-the-world flight. This was to have been her greatest achievement. Then to a waiting world came news of disaster as the plane failed to reach tiny Howland Island in mid-Pacific.
Man, I just love how newsreels sounded back then. But history buffs are getting a new look at the famous disappearance of one of America's most famous aviators. Amelia Earhart disappeared 80 years ago this week during an attempt to set a round-the-world record flight by a woman. Schoolchildren ever since have been taught that her plane disappeared somewhere over the Pacific Ocean. But now a newly discovered photo suggests that that might not be true. Two people resembling Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, appear in a picture taken at the time of the disappearance back in 1937 in the Marshall Islands. There are other details, too, and many historians now believe that Earhart and Noonan survived a crash landing and died instead in a Japanese internment camp. Rick Gillespie, however, isn't so sure. He's executive director of the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, or TIGER, and he spent years investigating Amelia Earhart's disappearance. He's author of Finding Amelia, The True Story of the Earhart Disappearance. Rick, welcome to The Takeaway.
Todd, it's great to be here.
Let's talk about this newly discovered photo discovered in the National Archives. It features several people on a dock. One looks a lot like Noonan, and another person with their back turned to the camera looks like Amelia Earhart, and in the water behind them, you can see a ship that's towing a plane that many have said looks like Earhart's plane, a Lockheed. Do you buy it?
Well, let's correct a couple of things here. First of all, it's not a newly discovered photograph. We've had that photograph for a year, and there is so much wrong with this, I hardly know where to start. We dismissed it right away as ridiculous, but it turns out that the Daily Mail newspaper in England also had the photograph a year ago. They got curious and they hired an investigator to check the National Archives to verify this story. What they find is that this photograph came out of a packet of other photographs that are labeled to have been taken after 1940. This is not a 1937 photograph. This is a photograph taken at least 3 years after Earhart disappeared. Okay, let's talk about the woman who is alleged to be Amelia Earhart, if she is a woman. There's a person sitting on the edge of the dock, facing the other way. We can't see the face, but whoever it is has a lot more hair than Amelia Earhart had at the time she disappeared. Talk about Fred Noonan, or the alleged Fred Noonan character. First of all, it doesn't look like Fred. He's dressed in white shirt and white trousers. Fred always dressed in a dark shirt and dark trousers. But we've recently learned that the photograph that they used to show that the man in the photograph's hairline, receding hairline, is the same as Fred Noonan's, they reversed the photograph. You know, that's borderline fraudulent.
So, Rick, we've analyzed the photo a little bit. Are you suspecting a hoax here or just overexcited people for a new conspiracy or what?
Well, the Japanese conspiracy people are very excited, and they're always searching for some shred of real evidence to support their theory. There are no serious historians that think that there's any chance that Earhart was captured by the Japanese. That's been debunked since the 1960s. And for somebody to come along and say, no, that's all wrong, and try to contradict what we've done with something that doesn't begin to hold up to real analysis, this is serious. And so we're going to take it seriously.
So, Rick, what does your best analysis say about what happened to Amelia Earhart?
It's quite clear that she flew on a navigational line. She said she was following in her last radio transmission to the Coast Guard cutter Itasca. She said she was running on a line north and south trying to find Howland Island. Well, she didn't find Howland Island, but there's another island on that line. And the U.S. Navy at the time she disappeared reasoned that, well, if she didn't find Howland, maybe she found the other island that's on that line. It was then called Gardner Island. Today it's Nikumaroro. And they were so suspicious that she had gotten to this island that they dispatched a battleship from Pearl Harbor to sail the 2,000 miles south and check out the island. Meanwhile, while the battleship's on its way, people all around the Pacific, professional radio operators and amateurs in the United States, started hearing radio distress calls from the airplane. This went on night after night, widely believed confirmed by the Coast Guard. Yes, this appears to be genuine. Putnam, her husband, says, thank God they're safe and so forth. And then Lockheed, the airplane manufacturer, chimes in and says, hey, guys, if you're hearing radio calls from that airplane night after night, it's on land. It can't be floating around in the water because the radios won't work if the airplane's in the water. And not only that, she has to be able to recharge the battery to send this many signals. And the only way she can do that is to run an engine. And for her to run an engine, she has to be on her wheels. So this airplane has made a safe landing someplace. And there's just not a lot of land out there. So the Navy figures, well, we've got it. You know, she's on land. She's on her wheels. She's landed at Gardner Island. As soon as our ship gets there, we'll be able to find her. Everybody expected a happy ending to this. But about a day and a half before the ship got there, the radio signals stopped. We are quite sure that they stopped because the airplane had been landed on the reef that surrounds the island. It's flat and smooth, dries at low tide, but the tide comes in. And each day the tide came in at that time of year, it got higher. And by the sixth night, the tide had washed the airplane over the edge of the reef into the ocean, into the surf, no longer visible. So on July 9th, 1 week after the disappearance, three airplanes from the battleship Colorado fly over Gardner Island looking for the airplane. No airplane. And they reason, well, for those signals to be genuine, the airplane had to be on land. We've looked on the land, there's no airplane. Therefore, somehow, all those radio signals must have been hoaxes or bogus or misunderstandings or something. We think what happened to her is she survived on the island as a castaway for certainly a matter of weeks, maybe months, before dying. In 1940, 3 years after she disappeared, a British colonial officer found a partial skeleton at a castaway's campsite on the island. There was part of a woman's shoe and a box that contained a sextant. And he said, wow, this might be Amelia Earhart. He notified the British authorities. But they misidentified the bones as a man, and the whole incident vanished from history until we tracked down the original British file in 1998. And we now know, based on the doctor's measurements, that the castaway of Gardner Island was a woman of Northern European descent who stood about 5'7" and had some physiological characteristics that are identical to Amelia Earhart's. She was almost certainly Amelia Earhart.
A photograph casting new speculation and a lot of excitement over the idea that Amelia Earhart may have died at the hands of Japanese war forces in World War II. Rick Gillespie says, no way. He's executive director of the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery. Rick, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, we have been trying this week on The Takeaway to get you reading this summer. We've had your best summer reading lists, nonfiction and fiction, earlier this week. If you insist on turning on the television this summer and being one of those people, well, I'm with you also. Melissa Locker is here. She's culture reporter for The Takeaway with the summer's best television viewing. Welcome, Melissa.
Hi, Todd.
We should say at the top, the only thing that matters is Game of Thrones. I think we both know that.
Absolutely.
Season 7 is coming up later in July, so we're definitely going to talk about that. Before we get to that, we should talk about something else on television beside Game of Thrones. Insecure has been a huge hit.
You want to break up with me? You
know, Molly's waiting on me. I'm going to spend the night at her house. And we can talk about this tomorrow.
Hey, Issa!
See you later.
Hey, Ace!
Yeah, Insecure is great. It's by Issa Rae. It's on HBO. If you haven't seen it before, you know, Issa Rae, she's such an incredible comedic talent. And she's really been able to shine on Insecure. And luckily, we were getting a second season pretty quickly after the first season ended. It kind of ended on a little bit of a cliffhanger, a very dramatic moment involving her boyfriend. And season 2 kind of picks up right where it left off. And I am really excited to see what's going to happen. And I think people will like it.
Fans of British TV and fans of crime get a double hit with Broadchurch, which is going into its third season now.
And we'll need you to give a sample of DNA. We'll be asking everyone at the party to do the same. It's completely voluntary.
No problem. I was thinking, when I was making the list up, we knew everybody there. So that means one of our friends could have done this.
Yeah, so this is Broadchurch's third and final season, and honestly, it kind of shouldn't exist because season 2, they basically wrapped up the case that held them over for season 1 and season 2, but then the showrunner is actually going on to Doctor Who, and I think he wanted to wrap everything up in Broadchurch, so he brought it back for a whole new season. It's the last one, and they're looking at a very, like, intense assault case that's happening in their very cute, idyllic, beachy town in England. And so far, It started just last week, so there's only been one episode so far. It's very easy to catch up, and it is really, like, the first season was one of the best crime dramas probably ever.
Mm. So that's Broadchurch in its third season, but you've got a new show on here as well, which is Snowfall, set in Los Angeles and the crack epidemic.
Yeah, so Snowfall is kind of FX's big push show for the summer. It's by John Singleton, who obviously has a lot of incredible, you know, movie chops. And it looks at, yeah, the rise of the crack epidemic in Los Angeles in the 1980s.
You said if there was ever a problem, you were the man to see.
I guess that means there's a problem.
I need you to take a ride with me, Teddy.
You can bring the gun if it makes you more comfortable.
There are definitely some parallels between John Singleton and the main character that, you know, you can read about everywhere. But it's just, it's a pretty interesting show. And it's only had one episode so far. So also, it premiered on Wednesday night. So it's very easy to catch up. And I think people will really enjoy it, at least to sort of see kind of this history of the rise of crack cocaine, which you wouldn't necessarily see on TV before.
Okay, boxes checked. That's three shows you can watch while you're killing time for season 7 of Game of Thrones on HBO. Look, everybody is headed towards King's Landing. By the way, if you're not caught up, there might be some spoilers in this Game of Thrones section here. If you haven't watched season 6, just be aware of that.
Just lunge for the radio dial right now. Turn it off.
Melissa, Jon Snow is back from the dead, obviously, and has amassed his army, and he's not alone.
There will be more fights to come. House Glover will stand behind House Stark, as we have for 1,000 years.
And I will stand behind Jon Snow. The king in the north!
He is not alone. He has friends. He has people gathered around him. He is teamed back up with his sister, Sansa, which is amazing to see. There's so many things that could happen in this next season. I mean, you have Daenerys coming in with her dragons. You have Cersei just making a serious play for the Iron Throne by herself. It's kind of crazy. Like, there's so many things happening. And this is going to be the penultimate season. So, you know, there's a lot that has to happen. Being the showrunner for that show must be insane. Like, they must have, like, the full-on, like, crazy person. Like, you know when you're, like, people are always trying to crack a crime in a TV show and they have, like, lines drawn everywhere and their whole room is plastered? Because how do they keep it all straight? I don't even get it.
That's also a map of my brain, starting on July 16th on HBO. I'm sure it is yours too, Melissa Locker, culture reporter for The Takeaway. Thanks.
Thanks, Todd.
I've come here to say one magic word to you. Cheeseburger.
What's a magic word?
Just say the magic word.
You didn't say the magic word.
Abracadabra.
Abracadabra. Abracadabra, Holmes.
What's the magic word?
Open sesame.
Matu, ferrata, nicto. Okay.
What is the magic word, Mr. Beckman?
Please.
It's Friday on The Takeaway. That's movie day on this show when Rafer Guzman of Newsday and The Takeaway joins us to give you your movie orders for the big weekend. Hi, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
It's great to have you here. We've got three films that you've brought to us this weekend. There's a big, giant, brand new Spider-Man blockbuster. How many is this in the series now?
Oh, I couldn't even say. Three, four, five, six, maybe?
Who can say how many Spider-Man movies they are, but there is a new one. There's a new romantic comedy from Kumail Nanjiani, The Big Sick, which I've seen. It's very funny. And a biopic of Canadian folk artist Maude Lewis that's also out. The Big Sick is coming out. Here's trivia, by the way. We're going to ask this question about Holly Hunter, who is in The Big Sick also. If you know this one, hit me up on Twitter. Rafer's not going to answer now. He's going to hold on to this and see if he can answer this at the end of the segment. Holly Hunter is in The Big Sick along with Ray Romano and a couple of other great performances. So here's Holly Hunter. Here's trivia. Name this movie.
And you can't marry him.
I can, I am, and I will. Tomorrow. I got to think about the little Warby gals. They look to me for answers.
That's Holly Hunter. Can you name that film? I sure hope you can. Let's move on, Rafer Guzman, because you're squinting at me like you might not know it, but we'll get to it. Spider-Man, Homecoming. Robert Downey Jr. is in this one. Michael Keaton. Let's listen.
You're the Spider-Man from YouTube.
I'm not.
You were on the ceiling.
I wasn't. Ned, what are you doing in my room?
You may let me in. You said we're going to finish a Death Star.
She doesn't know. Nobody knows. Well, I mean, Mr. Stark knows because he made my suit, but that's it.
Well, Tony Stark made you that. Are you an Avenger?
Yeah, basically. Dude, you can't tell anybody about this. Gotta keep it a secret.
Tom Holland is Peter Parker, and Spider-Man.
That's right. This is his first big standalone movie. He's gonna carry the Spider-Man character forward from here on out. I think there's a lot riding on this film. Obviously, you've got this botched franchise, the one with Andrew Garfield that fizzled out, and this is Spider-Man's chance to get folded back into the Marvel Universe. What's great about this film, two things. No origin story. We don't have to sit through that again. Mm-hmm. No Uncle Ben. We don't have to sit through the death of Uncle Ben again. Very glad about that. We get right to the good stuff. Peter Parker in high school, the shrimpy kid, nerdy, but of course, secretly, he's a superhero. And the fun part also is, you know, as you heard in that clip, he says he's an Avenger, but he's not really quite an Avenger yet. He's trying to convince Tony Stark that he's worth joining the Avengers team. So I thought this was really fun, really smart.
You seem excited. It's not an overstimulating mess, because sometimes that's what these films can be to me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, let's be clear. This is a Marvel movie. This is a superhero film, and
sure,
you're going to get all that flash and bang that you get with superhero movies. But what's great are the high school scenes and this multicultural cast that makes it look very much like Queens. You know, Peter Parker's crush is African-American this time, and his friend is Filipino-American. All that stuff, I think, works really well, and I thought it was a really good start to the series.
So that's the new Spider-Man movie. The Big Sick is a much quieter film. This
yes.
is a romantic comedy with Kumail Nanjiani, Zoe Kazan, and, of course, Holly Hunter, who is the subject of trivia. Let's listen.
I have to tell you that when you yelled at me, it really threw me off, and you really shouldn't heckle comedians. It's so rude.
I didn't heckle you. I just woohooed you. It was supportive.
Okay, that's a common misconception.
Uh-huh.
But yelling anything at a comedian is considered heckling. Heckling doesn't have to be negative.
Rafer, I confess, I got dragged to this one by my mom because it was her birthday. It's what she wanted to see, so I agreed. I laughed my head off. I loved it.
It's really just a lovely, lovely film. It's almost 100% autobiographical, just about Kumail Nanjiani, about his now wife, Emily, when she got sick in the middle of their dating. In this version, he has broken up with her. He has told her, listen, I'm going to get an arranged marriage. I'm Pakistani-American. That's what we do. I can't lose my family. She falls ill. He comes to her bedside, meets her parents, Ray Romano and Holly Hunter, and realizes that this woman might just be the love of his life. I think if you've seen Master of None, Aziz Ansari, you might notice some similarities here, some of the same issues, but it's this much deeper, much more, I think, heartfelt film than the series. I love this movie. It's become a huge hit. I think it's going to go forward as it's opening wide and get a lot of traction. It's a really wonderful film.
The comedic talent of all four main players in this film just carries it right along.
Yeah.
Quiet, boring conversations that are unbelievably entertaining.
And tackling all these issues that we're all thinking about right now, race, religion, immigration, all these things. I think it handles it all really well.
Sally Hawkins and Ethan Hawke are in the new Maudie, which takes place in Nova Scotia.
Oh, well, I don't do larger paintings, just the little cards.
I'm willing to pay your price.
Mm-hmm. She does. Yeah, we got some fine gobs of paint here splashed on these boards.
No.
Oh, yeah, these will be right up your alley.
There. Look at that.
A quiet film. Also, Ethan Hawke's career has matured into sort of an independent kind of quiet career.
Yeah, I mean, here he's playing this abusive husband of Maude Lewis, who is this arthritic and kind of hunchback artist living in Nova Scotia, who gets a moment of fame for a while for painting these really lovely, she's self-taught, but she paints these really lovely childlike figures, you know, animals, nature scenes, and they're really beautiful. I think this film doesn't quite know what to do with their relationship. It's actually not the most pleasant relationship, and I think it's caught somewhere between showing the ugly side of Ethan Hawke's character and trying to sort of fashion him into a kind of comedic and sensitive and loving figure. It doesn't quite strike that balance the right way, at least not to me. But one thing I did like about this, I was not that familiar with Maude Lewis at all before I went in, and those paintings really are something beautiful to look at. It makes me want to go to her house in Nova Scotia where you can still see some of her work.
And if you're someone who follows Ethan Hawke from film to film, though, you still might enjoy this one, because some people do.
I think you would. I think despite his best efforts here, still, he just can't bring that character into focus. I'm not sure that's really his fault as an actor, though.
Interesting. Okay, well, we talked about Holly Hunter for trivia, which I want to get back to you, Rafer, before we go. I'm not sure if you know this one. Holly Hunter is one of the stars of The Big Sick, along with Ray Romano and some other folks in some great performances. I played you a clip of Holly Hunter.
And you can't marry him.
I can, I am, and I will. Tomorrow. I gotta think about the little Warby gals. They look to me for answers.
Name that film.
This is why I don't go on Jeopardy. My mind's a complete blank, Todd.
That is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? The Coen brothers.
Of course.
Rafer Guzman, Newsday film critic, and with us here at The Takeaway. I'm a little disappointed in me.
I'm sorry, Todd.
Have a great weekend. I'm Todd Zwillick, and this is The Takeaway.